and welcome to this month's edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Emma Burnell, and I'm a political journalist, political consultant, and playwright. And I'm joined, as always, by academic Professor Stephen Fielding from Nottingham University. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Emma. Hello, listener. I hope everyone's had an enjoyable bank holiday, because we should have recorded this on Bank Holiday Monday. In fact, we should have recorded it a few days before, but there have been cock-ups, technical errors. This is a doomed podcast, so anything can happen in the next half an hour.
When Steve says cock-ups, what he politely means is I completely forgot we were supposed to when I went shopping with a friend.
You went shopping? I thought it was work. I thought it was... Ah, now you can say it's with shopping. Right.
I went shopping with my lovely friend Caroline, who I was supposed to have met weeks ago, and it kept getting delayed and for her birthday, so I did owe her one. But there you go. We bought lipstick, if it helps.
I'm sure our listener, you know, panting though they must be for the next episode of Zeitgeist Tapes, our listener is happy to wait a couple of more days. So hopefully that's all right with them.
So this month we are doing My Choice, and I chose this for a couple of reasons. We're looking at Edge of Darkness, the early 1980s six-part drama around the nuclear power industry, largely, but it brings in a lot of other threads. It's sort of a political thriller, a conspiracy thriller, an environmental thriller. I thought it was interesting. I mean, to be honest, I first suggested this when the Russians were in the process of setting fire to nuclear power stations, thus making the world considerably more nervous about them again. And I found the journey around nuclear power as opposed to nuclear weapons quite interesting on the left, because the core sort of environmental group in Edge of Darkness are called Gaia, named so after the Gaia conspiracy, the Gaia, what's the word I'm looking for? You're an academic, but Gaia...
Theory.
Yes. Which sort of says that the Earth will rid itself of the virus that is humanity in order to continue to survive. And there's an important metaphor around black flowers working to reflect the rays of the sun when the ozone, when global warming had hit the first time around. And in terms of nuclear energy, that's obviously very interesting, because there is now a much greater split on the left, whereas previously all nuclear energy was seen very bad. Just a holdover from, you know, nuclear weapons and too close to those, that we shouldn't be putting such dangerous materials in the hands of the private sector. Now, because of the immediate and catastrophic dangers of climate fuels, that debate has moved on somewhat on amongst environmentalists, has become much more controversial. So it's quite interesting to look at from a number of different perspectives. But equally, it's a very, very well-known drama that I hadn't seen, and I felt like it was a big gap in my knowledge. So Steve, you, of course, have not only seen it, but consider yourself somewhat of the expert on Edge of Darkness.
Oh, I would hesitate to say that.
I've say it on recording. You said it to me yesterday.
Anyway, yes, all right. Well, I've written about it in my much unread book, A State of Play. I've watched it quite a few times as a consequence of that. I'm not sure, because it came out in 1985 on BBC Two, because it was considered to be, you know, a bit of a middle class, bit of a highfalutin kind of a thriller. But it was so popular that the BBC started to repeat it almost straight away on BBC One. So it actually had quite a bit of a popular impact in terms of the audience. And when I was doing my research for the book and whatever, I looked at BBC audience research for that. And people who watched it actually said they felt it was quite realistic, you know, made them worried, you know, it was a drama, but it was a drama that was in 1985 dealing with live issues. And the interesting thing is the extent to which some of those issues are still live today. I think, you know, that's kind of what you were saying there, Emma. So it was written by Troy Kennedy Martin, who by that point was like a god, a writing god, and he could do virtually anything, you know, he wanted. I mean, he made his name in the 1960s. He did all kinds of films. He wrote The Italian Job, you know. So he had kind of a mixed career, but a very successful career. But he also had strong politics, and this series does express quite obvious left-wing politics. And it posits a conspiracy of those in power.
Yeah. I think it's
against us.
It sets the tone for that, doesn't it? Very early on, when you see real-life MP Michael Meacher speaking to a group of students, which is the clip that we've chosen. So maybe we'll set the tone for the rest of the podcast by listening to that now.
Yes, good idea.
But I say this too, that I believe that there are new forces in our society. New forces, new loyalties, new ideas, not yet articulated, which may yet come to our rescue. Now, some of them will come from the Labour Party. Yeah! And some of them will come from other associations, perhaps not yet formed. I accept that as well. But I say this, that in whatever shape these new forces manifest themselves, they will come from you, the despised students of humanity. Yeah! It is you and your generation who will have to confront the frightening dangers that lie ahead. It is you that will have to deal with the dangers that I've outlined. Yeah. But I believe you and your generation, the new rising generation, yeah, you do have the courage, the optimism, and the determination. Yeah. You will do.
So some say that's the best speech Michael Meacher ever gave, and it wasn't written by him. I think I'm the person that says it's the best speech. I think I'm just being unnecessarily cruel.
If you get a really world-famous writer to write your words for you, it is going to be quite a good speech. I mean,
yeah, it probably is.
If Barack Obama got Lin-Manuel Miranda to write a speech from, it would be better.
It would be very good. Yes, that's true. But I mean, just so our listener who might not know who Michael Meacher is, I suppose we should say he was described as Tony Benn's representative on Earth by more sarcastic journalists, and did in fact run for the deputy leadership in 1983. Didn't get anywhere, but you know, he was. On the left, he was kind of, you know, quite a significant figure. So to have him talking like that, and that's the kind of speech he would have given, I'm sure, and many on the left, far left, would have given as well. So that was, but that sets the tone, doesn't it? So the hope of the new generation.
I mean, that's it. I mean, the speech is good. It tonally, it doesn't say anything. You know, it's your classic politician goes to speak to idealistic young people speech, because what he does, yes, is absolutely gee them up, absolutely tell them that they are the future, absolutely tell them that everything is wrong, absolutely, yes, give them no solutions.
but unusually in this drama, the person who organised it is the daughter of a kind of apolitical or small c conservative police officer. And she is a student activist. In fact, she's an academic. I think she's an academic. She's so young.
Given her background and her seniority amongst the other groups that she's in.
Yeah, I mean,
she looks a wee Ben.
I know. But anyway, she's an academic of some sort. And he's also an activist, a Gaia activist. And the whole thing kicks off when the father picks the daughter up from the meeting, goes back home, and then she's shot and killed.
Right in front of him.
Yes, and it's not entirely clear whether he was the he was meant to be the victim and she stood in front of the person who fired the gun, or that she was, maybe she was meant to be the person. And it's never very, you know, the whole thing is about who murdered her. That's the thing that's the kind of the device that gets everything going. And as that develops, then the bereaved father, Ron Craven, who the only reason I remember his name is because that was the name of someone who used to live next door to us, Ron Craven. bizarre.
I'm going to call him John Craven by accident. I'm sure I am.
Oh, John Craven. Yes. But he, starting off as this apolitical, quite conservative, quite critical of his daughter's kind of ecological politics and ignorant about much of what she was doing, he, as trying to find out who murdered, what, you know, why this happened, he's drawn into this conspiracy or to uncovering a conspiracy, which involves privatization of a supposed nuclear waste processing plant, which isn't waste processing.
No, it's not supposed to be a waste processing plant.
Oh,
that's part of the problem. It's they're not supposed to have the plutonium that they have.
They're actually producing plutonium.
And they are that they have this and that it becomes public or publicish knowledge, parliamentary knowledge at least, is at least in part because the daughter, Emma, fabulous name, she and a group of friends break into this facility to retrieve proof.
To find evidence, yes.
And give that proof to people who are campaigning on this. And are therefore labelled terrorists by the government.
Yes. Yes, all that, because the word terrorist is thrown around a lot. And yeah, they are deemed to be terrorists, but then a character who we may discuss, where we probably will discuss, the CIA agent, bizarre CIA agent, Jedberg, he actually says anybody kind of that messes around with plutonium is a terrorist. So, you know, the whole, everyone's a terrorist, essentially.
I found Jedberg the most confusing character.
Well, yes, he was odd to say that. I don't think he was the most credible CIA agent, although I don't know any CIA agents, so maybe he is, that's what they're all like. I don't know, but yeah, going around London with a Stetson hat on in a white Rolls Royce, carrying a bag of golf clubs. I don't know if that's, you know, he was a bizarre character.
It felt to me, and I don't know if the timeline is right, but it felt quite inspired by Local Hero. In terms of his sort of American, and particularly when he was in Gleneagles, maybe. But more than his character, which was very odd and eccentric, his motivations seemed to be all over the place.
This is the thing about this conspiracy, because we're kind of sent in one direction, that it seems to be this private company is illegally producing plutonium, but we don't know what it's about. And it's and there's a big American multinational corporation that wants to buy this company. And so there are these members from the British intelligence and Jedberg from the CIA are trying to investigate the company and its motives and what's really going on behalf ostensibly of their two governments. But then it transpires at the very end that the British intelligence and Jedberg were both being manipulated by their respective governments, who wanted the sale to go through because they were both, the governments that is, conspiring to produce more plutonium, and it was being produced in this supposed just a waste sort of facility, processing facility, to engineer a new Cold War and new nuclear weapons. So there's all these layers which might get a bit confusing on a first watch. I don't know. But the reason why, I mean, Jedberg thinks he's working on behalf of the CIA and then discovers that he's being betrayed by the CIA and his bosses. So, but he is a bizarre character to start with, to be perfectly frank, you know.
And
trying to bring a bit of colour.
He set up Gaia under Carter.
Yeah.
And the inference is that Carter was anti-private sector nuclear activity, and therefore the CIA was all of a sudden really like peace and which
they wanted to build up a voice in favour of that. But then when Carter's policy changed, then they dropped it. But by that point, they created it. So there's that. So there are all these little conspiracies within conspiracies, and Northern Ireland gets mentioned quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, Edge of Darkness came out in 1985, but that's in the middle 1980s, there were quite a few. In fact, it was a whole wave of conspiracy dramas on film and on TV in Britain. All of them kind of had at their heart, it was mostly about nuclear power, nuclear weapons, the Cold War, the nuclear state, secrets about that. And they often threw in references to Northern Ireland because they were kind of saying, well, all that shit, you know, that was done in Northern Ireland, it's now coming into Britain. All those kind of surveillance techniques were all being used against us now.
Well, so I was a child in the 1980s and living in London, and I remember bombs. The Northern Ireland situation wasn't history then; it was what we were living through.
The IRA nearly assassinated.
It would be quite odd, I suppose, to have a British political drama that didn't at least tangentially mention it.
Yeah, but the way in which they mentioned it was that all those intelligence surveillance techniques that were, you know, learnt to oppress or try and contain IRA terrorism was now being used against us honest, decent citizens. Yes.
Well, yeah,
like Ron Craven.
Moving into those internal enemies, the enemy within. And the other thing that gets mentioned right at the very beginning, of course, is the miners.
Yes. Well, 85. Yes. 1945. Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. While they aren't the core thread of the drama, there's that sense that there's the British establishment, the American establishment, and the enemy within, which is everybody who's not one of those two. And even the American establishment, you're a bit confused by, as previously mentioned. The British establishment, there are people within that Parliamentary Select Committee who, again, which side are they on? They baffle the hell out of me.
Well, that was one of the, I mean, I think you've mentioned it before, that how dramas represent parliamentary process is just ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, there's the James Bond film, which, you know, when there's a shootout during one of them, that's absolutely crazy. And there is an investigation by Parliament, though it's not entirely clear who, where, what, and all that, into the sale of this nuclear waste facility. And it's just nuts, isn't it? I mean, it's just like, it's like they don't know how politics works.
All. And as someone who has written a political play, is currently having many negotiations about the tiniest nuances of language with my actors who don't understand the political implications of some of the things that I can't change that. That would literally break the rules. there is a certain amount of dramatic license to be had. But the problem is when you take that dramatic license in one place, but then get very serious about police procedural, it just seems a bit jarring.
Yes. Well, to be fair, it does go a bit crazy in the last couple of episodes when it's kind of revealed that the two intelligence people that on either side, the British and the American intelligence people that we think are working on behalf of their governments. Mm-hmm. And then it transpires they're not, their governments are working against them because both governments want this thing to go through and they want to produce more plutonium because of the new Cold War. I mean, then it goes way off rails. I mean, there's elements in it that you go, that's interesting, but all right, I'll go along with that. Like, not for example, but most noteworthy is Ron Craven's daughter, who is killed right at the start. She starts to appear again, you know, talking to him. And you don't know whether, does this mean he's going a bit balmy? Because people are starting to say, I think you're going to need a bit of a rest.
And he is a psychiatrist, isn't he?
Yes, he goes into some kind of a place to have a little lie down. And you're not quite sure, is he really a bit bonkers? Because he's finding out all this stuff and it's taking him deeper and deeper. And in fact, he does go down a coal mine, you know, it really does go down a coal mine to find out the truth. And you go, okay, that's, we'll accept that, that he's seeing her and she's talking to him and all of that. But then it goes way off the rails when Jedburgh, who discovers that there's a conspiracy against him, you know, and then he takes the plutonium and then he explodes it. And there's a
military conference. He just wanders in with a grab bag full of plutonium.
Yeah. And that's after he played a round of golf with it, you know, where he's clearly suffering from radiation poisoning. So it goes a little bit, you know. And I don't know what you thought about the end, because we might as well talk about the end and then we can go back and talk about other things. But the end, but at the end, Ron Craven, who's gone down the mine to find the evidence about plutonium, they've kind of exposed, you know, right, we know what's going on. But actually, it doesn't matter because both governments want to sail to go through. So it does. So the global corporation buys it up and then the Second Cold War can go on. But Ron Craven has got radiation poisoning. We leave him on the top of a hill shouting the name of his daughter, Emma. He is shouting, Emma! And he's due to die in a couple of days. You know, he's going to peg it. Jedburgh, who, you know, tried to expose things, he's dead, or is he about to die? You know, it's like the conspiracy, we discover what it is, and it works. It succeeds. It's going on.
The very last shot is Black Flowers on the Scottish Highlands.
Oh, yes.
Where Ron Craven is about to die.
Yes.
Now, I read that what Troy Thingy Martin wanted to do,
yes,
to have Ron Craven turn into a tree at the end.
Well, that shows you the level of lunacy that was at loose there.
He stopped from doing that by the cast and crew, and they were like, look, so far
no
further. So they ended with, you know, the where he's fallen black flowers.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, because I guess it's not a very optimistic drama, although it was in 1980, so why should it? But yeah, with the black flowers, I think the implicit message, at least I thought it was, you might have thought it was different, of all these black flowers, which we have been told, you know, when the humans poison the earth one way or another, the black flowers will suck it all up
and then
regenerate. Yeah, we will regenerate without the human race. Yeah, without the human race. The implication was, right, there's going to be a nuclear war, you know, it's all going to kick off. And we're going to have to rely on these black flowers to save the earth, not us, because we'll be dead by then. So it's a pretty, you know, it's a conspiracy drama that's with left-wing intentions, which leaves you thinking, geez, the bad guys win. You know, it's not really kind of the kind of thing that Michael Meacher might have wanted, you know, a sort of get up, yeah, we can win if we've only got the win.
I mean, and that's interesting because I think that's a more 80s approach to this kind of drama. I'm thinking about things like Threads and stuff. Actually, a very bleak outcome is the hallmark of an 80s conspiracy or nuclear drama. And maybe that's because when you are living through that kind of nuclear paranoia, and God knows we may end up there again, you know, we're not too far off.
Yes.
A bleak outcome is what you envisage. I think that's probably something that tells a lot about the, not the sort of big P politics, but certainly the poor small P politics of the time. Is that how people felt?
Or left politics at the time. Because like I say, Troy Kennedy Martin, Michael Meacher, it was clearly a left, I mean, I'm surprised the Daily Mail didn't have a fit at the time about this. Maybe it did, or maybe the Daily Mail hadn't started to have fits about television programmes at this point, but it's very left-wing, and it's very pessimistic, and the two might go together.
I don't suppose that Mary Whitehouse cared one way or another, because there wasn't an awful lot of nudity.
No, there was very little sex. There was reference to sex, but there was very little. In fact, I was going to say actually, because another hallmark of 1980s, well, not just conspiracy dramas, was the absence of women. And there are only like two characters that could main characters. I mean, one is Ron Craven's daughter, who starts off dead, so she's a ghost. Dad, you should do the right thing here. You know, she's like an angel. She's like an angel, really, guiding him. Which is a kind of bit.
Because she is his projection, essentially, of his daughter.
Yeah, it's not even her. It's, yes, not you're absolutely her.
It's an idealized version of a daughter, her. So, of course, she's not really having sex.
Oh, yeah, yes. And then there's another character who just seem to throw her in to have some sex.
Zoe Wanamaker just turns up. Hello, I'm Zoe Wanamaker. Let me sleep with you for some episodes, not do very much else.
And that was it. Yeah, that was it. Yeah, she was literally there for a bit of bonking, as they would have said in the 1980s. So it's a very male-driven drama, but you know, politics was, I suppose, but it's one of those things you notice. I mean, there's another character who appears, and that's Margaret Thatcher on TV being interviewed by Robin Day, which is actually, that was something at the time. Robin Day apparently didn't like that because the idea that you had a drama and then you put in real people, even though it's people watching real people on the telly, didn't like that. And actually the interview that she was doing with Robin Day was when she was talking about nuclear weapons and this and that. So it all tied in. And it made the political point quite clear, you know, basically.
The thing in the 80s, nuclear power, Nine Danker, was absolutely synonymous with anti-nuclear missile movements.
Oh, yeah. You Greenham Common. You went to Greenham Common, didn't you?
I did indeed go to Greenham Common. One of my proudest moments. That I had one of my proudest political moments when I was 8 years old is probably quite telling about me, but there you go.
All downhill since then.
Absolutely.
Right. So, because it raises a lot of things that are a bit 1980s, but there are some more underlying things about the environment, but it's all, like you were saying, it's tied in with the nuclear thing and that the nuclear industry was a danger to the environment.
Yeah, and I think
global warming wasn't in it.
What I think is interesting is it doesn't actually explore the problems I have with there being a privatised nuclear industry, which is privatisation is about maximising corporate shareholder profit. Maximising corporate shareholder profit does not lend itself to a safety first environment. And therefore, I don't trust such an organisation to be in charge of the planet's most dangerous materials.
Hmm.
But that didn't really get a look in. It was, just evil corporation does evil things.
Yes. Yeah, then they were evil, weren't they? I mean,
they were very evil. They were happy to basically flood chambers full of activists so that they all died.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they killed all the activists who were, and because his daughter, because Ron Craver's daughter would in the end have died of radiation poisoning had she not been shot. So,
because part of how this all comes out is that her body is found to be very radioactive.
Yes,
Once again, I mean, I'm banging on my same old, it's the wrong argument, the wrong nuance drum. I thought it was a gripping drama. It did go a bit mental.
Yes.
At points, and it lost me a little bit. I was like,
No, I could. Yeah. I mean, I think I only really got it after watching it twice. The conspiracies within the conspiracy.
But I thought it was forgetting. I thought Bob Peck's central performance was really good. I mean, very quiet, strong, masterful. At no point did I not believe that he was a grieving father finding himself confused by an ever-increasing rabbit warren of policy. So I thought and he played that really well.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bit odd, sort of jarring of styles, because he was very naturalistic, you know, he played it, you know, as you would, just trying to be, you know, as realistic as possible. And then there's the Jedburgh character who is just off the scale
I would love to see a spin-off where Jedburgh goes to the local hero village. Because that's how I see him. He's very much the Charlton Heston, it wasn't Charlton Heston.
Bert Lancaster,
thank you.
Yes. Well, maybe that's just how British writers wrote about Americans at a certain point. You know, that was their stereotype.
Yeah, and actually, if you think about it, what was America telling us they were at that time? Well, they were telling us they were J.R. Ewing.
So, yes.
You know, it's not that odd that we took them up on their word.
Yeah, but well, Local Hero, I've just, because I've Googled it, I haven't just, Local Hero is 1983, so maybe it did have some kind of an influence, but maybe. It was, yes, big mouth American. So yeah, it's six part, could have done maybe with one less part, I think.
Yeah, it could have been tighter and less bonkers at times,
yeah.
But overall, I think a really gripping watch.
Yeah, and I thought, I mean, maybe because I lived through that time, so it didn't look 30 years. I mean, I mean, other than people weren't on mobile phones.
Nobody's on a mobile phone, and the cars always really date things for me.
Yes.
Oh, and how dirty London is.
Right. Well, compared to today.
Then compared to now, yeah, we're much, much better at keeping our buildings scrubbed up.
All right, okay.
And also particulate, although we have terrible air quality problems, terrible air quality problems, they're invisible. They're not black particulate. So what cars are pumping out is just as bad for us, but not as visibly bad for us now.
Right. Okay, well, that's reassuring. So, yes, I would say a definite thumbs up. I think, you can watch it. You have to buy it, I think, or rent it off Amazon. There is a film. There's a film version of this.
I have not watched the film version of this.
I've watched it. Don't bother. Don't bother.
I saw two words, Mel and Gibson, and thought, nah.
Yeah. No, it's an abomination, really, compared to the TV series. So don't bother. If you think you want to have a shortcut, watch the TV series.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. Great, lovely. Well, I think we've probably reached the edge of our darkness.
Ooh. Towards the light. We've gone towards the light.
Into the light, Leland.
Yes.
Okay, so I mean, I thought that was I would definitely recommend watching it to anyone who hasn't, and I know lots of people for whom it's a real favourite. And unlike quite a lot of the times that we've covered people's real favourites on here, I don't think we're walking away going, "You idiots, that shouldn't be your favourite." So that's a nice feeling.
Yes.
We will be back in a month. We're going to do a very special episode next month where Steve is going to interview me about my new play. Tickets
and Emma's going to write me the questions that I'm going to ask her,
all of the wonderful, completely hagiographer. But we tickets for the play are available. You can meet at least me and hopefully Steve at some point too, if you can make it down. You should bring a whole bunch of your students, Steve. Other people are we look forward to speaking to you then. In the meantime, do go away and enjoy Edge of Darkness, if you haven't already. But please, please, in the meantime, could you rate and review the podcast if you enjoy it? It really helps people to find us. This has been a Political Human production.
And the theme tune?
Oh, and the theme tune is by Lord Stuart Wood of Anthony.